The Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra opens its season on Saturday night at Miller Auditorium. And here to preview the concert with me are the guest soloist, violinist Jennifer Frouchy. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
And we have assistant conductor of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, Daniel Breyer. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for letting me come back.
Of course. This is an exciting program, I've been telling listeners. One of the great violin concertos of all time, and a Tchaikovsky symphony that also might rank right up there, can't be beat. So I'll start with you, Daniel. You are a natural-born conductor, so you can give us maybe an overview of how this evening will go and some things you're excited about.
Yes, well, I'm really excited about the program because Tchaikovsky 6 is one of the symphonies that I've grown up listening to. I remember first hearing it on cassette tape, and then, you know, I've heard it, listened to it many times, and then I always wanted to do it, so it's really, really exciting for me to be able to work with our orchestra on this piece. I'm also excited about the first work on the program, which is a work by a living composer. His name is George Walker. He was born in 1922.
I was going to say, he must be 80 or 90.
Yes, yeah, he's 95 years old,
oh, wow.
And he still answers his emails, and it's really an amazing thing, and his music is really wonderful music, and I'm very excited to open the program with his Sinfonia No. 4.
George Walker was the first African-American composer to win a Pulitzer Prize for
music.
That's
correct, yes.
Yeah, yeah. His music is both on the tonal spectrum, but he can also bring some dissonance when he wants to.
Yes, yes, yeah. Especially his later music. And this is it's his most recent orchestral piece. There's one more in the works, but it's his most recent orchestral work.
Tell me the title again.
Sinfonia No. 4, and it actually has a subtitle called Strands. And the idea is taking a few disparate elements and then fusing them together like a mosaic. And so it's really interesting. He takes two spirituals and then two very modern, small musical motives, little tiny melodies, and he puts it all together into one about 10-minute work.
Was this piece a piece that you were able to suggest to the orchestra?
Yes, this is a work that I was able to program. And I was very excited to program it because earlier this year I had been reading a lot of James Baldwin and some Maya Angelou, and I started thinking, what is the musical equivalent to a mind that is, you know, it's a once-in-a-generation mind? And I stumbled across his music, and his most famous work is the lyric for strings, which is very similar to Samuel Barber's Adagio for strings.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started listening to his music more and more. That work was written in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And as he kept writing, it's almost as if Barber had kept writing. So it's very complex, but there's always that expression and that touch of romanticism there. It never leaves.
So he always takes care of,
yes,
care of your romantic ears.
He does.
George Walker, still responding to emails, you said?
Yes, yes.
Is he aware of this concert?
Yes, we've been corresponding all summer about this concert, so.
And you said there's another piece in the works, so he's still composing.
Yes, he's got
a
fifth sinfonia that will be premiered in the fall of 18 by another big orchestra.
I see.
So
is this for
inspiring.
The full orchestra, or is it a string piece?
It's a full orchestra. So we have winds by threes and full brass section, and then the percussion just covers the whole back of the stage. I mean, if it's a percussion instrument, it's probably there. So it's exciting.
Do you feel a big responsibility to advocate for this piece, which, you know, is one of many thousands you could have chosen, perhaps, and you chose this one?
Yes, I do. In fact, as an orchestra this year, it's kind of like a side project, but we are going to perform at least 20 works by different Black composers, stretching back to the Chevalier St. George, which is from the 1700s, all the way to George Walker, and a really young composer, but a fantastic composer, Jesse Montgomery. And we're going to do this. We have this work on our symphonic series. There's a work for the Young People's Concerts. We have several chamber works that are being premiered or performed all around town all throughout the season.
Well, the concert is Saturday. Music begins at 8 p.m. Will you be doing a pre-concert discussion at 7?
At 7, yes.
Okay, and that's at Miller Auditorium, and details are at kalamazoosymphony.com. I thought we'd be talking more about the big pieces on the program, but that is really exciting news. And I'm glad to hear you've had a hand in bringing African-American composers to the season this year.
Yeah, that's great. Think it, you know, and the important thing is for us to do music by living composers. And it's important for us to keep that music alive and being performed. It's really not so scary. Some people are very scared of contemporary music, but if you take the time to just listen, it's incredible what you can hear. And the imagination that these composers have is second to none.
Just got to take that chance.
Yes.
The concert again, 8 o'clock on Saturday. And Jennifer, let's see, where do we begin? How were your travels to Kalamazoo?
Very easy. I just got in last night.
You live in Brookline, Massachusetts?
In Boston, that's right.
Boston. Yeah. Yeah, well, I have a little sister who went to NEC and lives in Arlington.
Oh,
so
I see. I went to NEC as well.
Yeah. Your section of neighborhood is on the Green Line. I know that
much.
That's
right. Yep, I live right next to the Green Line. That's our public transportation system in Boston.
But as a concert soloist, you must travel an awful lot.
I do, yes. It's part of the... it's my least favorite part of what I do. I mean, I love being in different communities and sharing with meeting a lot of different people, meeting a lot of different musicians and audience members, and sharing music with people. But the actual act of traveling from place to place is just, you know, something that we have to bear with as musicians.
What are some highlights either coming up for you this season or something from last season that stands out as an unforgettable moment for you?
Well, actually, I have to say, we'll get to the Sibelius in a minute, and performing a work like the Sibelius is always incredibly exciting. Being on stage and being part of a symphonic texture like the Sibelius is something I always get really excited about because it's such an incredible piece to get to perform actually live. Actually, something I did just 2 weeks ago, I was at one of my favorite summer music festivals. It's the Moab Music Festival, which is in Utah in the southeastern corner of the state. For people who know Moab, it's a small town surrounded by several national parks and state parks. And the incredible thing about this festival is that there are some concerts that take place in traditional concert venues, but many of the concerts take place outside, taking advantage of the incredible landscape that's around there in that area. So Moab actually sits on the edge of Arches National Park, which is in just an incredible national treasure. But one of the concerts that I got to play while I was there is in a natural formation, a grotto that's on the Colorado River. And the only way to get there is by boat because it's just, you know, a grotto that's formed off of the river. And I've done this many times over the years because I go to this festival as often as I can. But getting to take a boat down the Colorado River surrounded by these incredible red canyons that you can only it looks like you're on a different planet. You know, the rock formations there, so strange, and the color is so striking, the red rock. And then landing at this grotto to which they cart a piano, a concert Steinway, and they bring in everything. They bring in the chairs. They bring in food. They bring in porta potties for the audience members. But to get to play outside, which is in this incredible, beautiful, natural setting,
fortunate.
Yeah, and so it's just very fresh in my mind, which is why I'm talking about it. As we head into fall, this is the last summer festival I did, and you know the weather was perfect. I played a Mozart sonata and Mozart clarinet quintet, two great masterpieces. But, you know, outside with, you know, we were doing our dress rehearsal, there was a crow that came and was croaking, cocking. And, you know, hearing the river rushing by, and it's really, yeah, that was a spectacular.
Did you bring the Stradivarius along with you?
I did bring the Stradivarius along, and it is risky in the sense that, I mean, the river trip, the boat, you know, all of that is very, very secure. But when you're out in the elements like that, it's very dry. So that's risky for any old wooden instrument, although I keep my hate case very carefully humidified and try to keep the instrument safe. And then there's always the risk that if it rains, there's no cover, there's nowhere to go. Yeah. However, it didn't rain. So
yeah. Your case,
they were saying, you know, if it starts to rain, just duck under the piano, throw the instruments under the piano.
Let the $80,000 Steinway take the, take the hit.
Right, right.
Well, that sounds very, just very unforgettable. I was great.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be able to take music to different settings, different people, to, you know, I love performing in concert halls, but it's can be a very special experience to test out the imagination and, you know, go out to the pedestrian mall and play, which is something I did as a kid, or go out on the river and play. So
this is something you could imagine yourself doing when you were young.
You mean being a performer?
When you were a child, yeah.
Yeah, when I was a child, I loved music and I did like performing, but I didn't envision becoming a performer. It wasn't actually on my radar as a possibility until I was well into my teens. But my family spent summers in Aspen from the time I was a baby, because my father actually worked there in the summers. And eventually my sister and I ended up enrolling in the Aspen Music Festival. But when I was a kid, meaning like age 7, 8, 9, my sister's 4 years older and she also plays a violin, we would go on the pedestrian mall in Aspen. I believe there's a pedestrian mall here in Kalamazoo, right? Which,
yes.
You know, just cobblestone with shops lining either side. And we just open up a case, set up two music stands and play duets. You know, we had the Bach double and some Vivaldi double concerto and some other
duet books,
right, that we'd read through and open up the case and people would throw in pennies, quarters, dollars, and
you'd get lots of ice cream out of that,
exactly.
I'm sure.
Yeah, a few.
Well, then you went on to a series of educational experiences that are really top-notch, both in your home state of California and then on the East Coast, and then launched a solo career, which I would imagine that those school days seem a little far, there's a little distance there now.
Yes, a little.
I was wondering what the years of actually being a concert artist have taught you that you weren't fully apprised of when you're under the care of a university professor or something like that?
That's a really good question. And I do think about that very question now that I've started teaching. And I think to myself, what are the things that I could impart to my students that I didn't, that you don't necessarily think to think about when you're a student, and that a conservatory or university education might not prepare you for. And, you know, when you're, and Daniel can certainly attest to this, when you're in school, you're in an environment where you're surrounded by people who are studying for the same thing. And so you have a lot of peers off of which you can bounce ideas or you can form a support system, right? For me, this might have been a different experience for Daniel, depending on what exactly you studied in school. But I loved the feeling of being in an area where everyone was practicing at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, and hearing other people practicing motivated me, made me feel like I wasn't alone in my practice room.
Sure.
Right. So I always loved that sound of walking by a music building and the windows are open and hearing, you know, French horn, piano and violin all at the same time. When you're in school, typically you have a relatively slow or slower pace in which to learn music. It's an environment in which, you know, you can take a semester maybe to learn a piece, right? and then you have a lot of resources. Like I said, you have your teacher you can go play it for. You have other faculty members. You have your friends or your studio mates who are in the same study with the same teacher. There are a lot of you know, you can very carefully and slowly learn things and have opportunities to get feedback on it and so on. And that's one of the main things that's different about going into the real world, is that the pace at which, in my career anyway, which I've had to learn a lot of music very quickly. And like someone was just asking me about my summer, and I think I did 8 different festivals, and every festival, there was one piece I repeated in the summer, I think, coincidentally, a Beethoven piano trio. But I went through a lot of chamber music, sonatas, I played a concerto. Every week is different. And so that's, you know, certainly when you're in school, you, between chamber music, orchestra, and solo lessons, you go through a fair amount of repertoire. The pace is so much slower. And when you, you know, are out there in the real world performing, one has to be so quick and able to juggle so much different repertoire. And in my case at this point, there are a lot of pieces I've already performed. Like I'm playing Sibelius this week, and it's a piece that I know very well. You know, I didn't have to learn it. but as the season goes on, there's always for me a mix of things I have to come back to, things that I maybe, you know, have been playing for years, other pieces that maybe I played twice, and then other repertoire that I'm learning for the first time. So what I try to convey to students is, you know, take the time when you're in school to really learn things very carefully, but also embrace the opportunity to develop that kind of agility to be able to play a lot of different repertoire, a lot of different styles too, and in a lot of different, we were talking about venues, and a lot of different settings as well, because particularly now I think the modern musician has to be very agile. When I talk about agile, I don't mean, you know, that your fingers have to move quickly. Yes, that too. But just agile in terms of being able to wear a lot of different hats and move between a lot of different
styles,
audiences, and so on. Yeah. And there are ways to, I think, develop that when you're a student, just by making yourself very open and available.
Daniel and I have talked about this in the past, and it's in some ways harder as a conductor because you can't conduct live people very
Correct.
Often.
Yes.
So while you're in school, and certainly after, you need to find very creative ways to stay agile.
Correct. Yeah. Right. There's so much. School is such a very wonderful time, but then once you get out, you have to be able to learn very fast. I mean, between now and October, I've got, you know, this program, but then a family concert, which is all Gershwin, and then Star Wars, you know, and that's within the space of about 4 or 5 weeks here. And in school, you have to be in school, actually, it prepares you to do that if you're willing to take the risk and be like, okay, I'll play this gig, and just show up prepared for every single thing that you do. And so I think that's the most important thing. In fact, yesterday I was talking with Western's convocation at the School of Music, and exactly the same thing I was telling them. Just, you know, be prepared at every gig you take, and take as many as you can.
Say yes, and then do the work.
Yes,
behind it.
Yeah. Right, and I see with younger players who are going through school, there are some who get this concept and others who don't. But one thing is, as a professional, I mean, yes, you can. You know, I have friends who are on one end of the spectrum or the other about taking breaks or taking vacations. But really, it's, I mean, one could say, okay, once a year I'm going to take a 2-week vacation, or, you know, however one might plan out one's year. I don't take vacations. In this, like an athlete, I have to, I mean, I don't mean to say that I practice my violin 365 days a year, but you really have to have a very consistent regimen of just practicing, which enables you to be agile in that way and to be prepared all
mm-hmm.
the time.
Yes.
And I sometimes see this with younger, you know, people who are in school who work very hard in bits and spurts, like during the semester. And as the semester goes on, they work harder and harder. But then, you know, there comes a break, and then they, you know.
You can lose it.
Yeah.
You can lose a lot of it.
Exactly. They're like, oh, well,
back.
I'm going home for the holidays, and we have this month-long break, and then same thing with the summer. And that is not, if you're a professional musician, you can't really do that. I mean, you know, you can, of course, build in breaks, but there's this concept of being constantly in shape in one sense or another. You know, as a conductor doesn't, you know, being in shape doesn't mean working out, but right. It means, you know, that there's a consistent regimen of...
Many do, yeah.
Of study and practice.
Well, I want to remind any listeners who may have tuned in the last few minutes that my guests are violin soloist Jennifer Frauci and conductor Daniel Breyer, and both will appear with the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra on Saturday with a concert beginning at 8 p.m., a pre-concert talk that Mr. Breyer here will present, will start at 7. And you can find out more right now at kalamazoosymphony.org or
.com.
And our website, WMUK.org, is where you can leave a pledge for this kind of programming on the radio in your community, bringing you classical music at hours during the day, and also interviews that take you right behind the scenes and give you that glimpse into, in this case, the life of a concert artist and how a conductor prepares a concert. So why don't we take a musical break? I would like to segue with a comment that we were talking about earlier. You mentioned new music. Of course, the Sibelius Concerto was brand new at one time. And I think it starts with an air of the unexpected, unimaginable. It has a very mysterious beginning. Why don't you set up the piece a little more between the two of you somehow?
Well, I've always loved the beginning because it just, there's an atmosphere that is unparalleled in all of the repertoire.
It's very unique.
So the strings start with a very muted texture and it's almost inaudible. It's just at the edge of being able to hear it. And then the soloist enters and maybe you can tell a little bit about how that movement kind of takes shape after that.
Yeah, so above this very mysterious and barely audible opening texture, which the audience has to strain to hear what's going on, the violin begins with a very, I think of it as a dark and... And it starts almost with a stark quality.
Yes, very.
Melody that then gradually unfolds and becomes quite stormy and dramatic. And so this first movement of the Sibelius Concerto is in three movements. And the first movement is really, I think, it's like a symphonic storm unfolds gradually. And there's, in the middle of the movement, there's a great... cadenza. It's very unconventionally written because usually there's cadenzas in violin concerto or in concerti come towards the end of the first movement, but this is really in the center. It's the middle of the movement.
Very strange for audiences expecting, you know, a traditional structure.
It is. And in fact, that big cadenza really serves the purpose of a development. It's where he introduces all of these themes, and usually the orchestra in the big concerto plays a big role in that moment, and he just strips the orchestra away, and it's only
the violin. Solo, yeah.
And it's an incredible cadenza.
Was this one of the pieces you learned while in school, slowly, or did...
It was. It's really one of, I'd say, five or eight violin concerti that are at the heart of the standard repertoire. So I learned it as a teenager and have come back to it many times over the years. I actually, when I first learned it, I did not play it with orchestra. It was a piece that I studied as part of, and I think if I remember correctly, I sort of learned it in bits and pieces, meaning I learned the first movement and then went on to something else and then at some point came back and learned the second and third movement. But yeah, I have had the opportunity to perform it a lot over the years, and it's the after the cadenza in the first movement, it builds up to a quite wild finale in the first movement. The last movement itself is very wild and has a wild buildup as well. But so it's very physical, the piece, and just even in with the first this, movement.
Yeah, even with this seductive beginning, it just, takes...
It ends up really in the, I'd say towards the end of the first movement, really exploding, actually.
Wow.
And it's very, very powerful. But to execute it requires quite a bit of physicality. And it's a workout.
Well, we have a recording here that features the great violinist Yasha Heifetz and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Let's give listeners a taste of what they can hear live on Saturday night with the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, played by Jennifer Frauci and conducted by Daniel Breyer. We heard Yasha Heifetz's recording of the Sibelius Violin Concerto. We just finished the first movement. And if you want to hear the full performance, you'll go and buy tickets now for the Miller Auditorium performance on Saturday night. My guests here today are both appearing in the concert, conductor Daniel Breyer and violin soloist Jennifer Frauci. Jennifer, before we heard the music, you mentioned that this piece is one of the, quote, 5 to 8 lifetime violin concertos.
It forms the heart of the violin canon.
I was just thinking, for those listeners out there who like lists and like checking things off of those lists, 8 performances is not that many, and you can take care of 1/8 of that list on
Saturday
hearing this concerto. And I'm just curious, top of your mind, what are 2 or 3 others that you just have to hear in a lifetime?
Beethoven, Brahms, Tchaikovsky are the 3 probably biggest ones, I'd say.
And Sibelius.
And then Mendelssohn. I could keep going, but Mendelssohn violin concertos,
Okay, well, this is your chance Saturday night with the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra and Daniel Breyer conducting. Let's move on to the Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 6, Pathetique, which would probably be on a top 10 list as well.
Yes, I think that would be on a top 10 list. It's definitely one of... You know, of all of the Tchaikovsky symphonies, it would be the one that I would listen to most, because I think there's more in it, and every time you hear it, you can really hear something new. And one of the things about the sixth is that there are some of the most perfect melodies ever written in the sixth symphony, especially in that first movement. There's a second theme that is the most beautiful theme you'll ever hear. And it's very accessible. It's the type of music that you listen to and you feel like you've known it for a long time, even though you might be hearing it for the first time.
Tchaikovsky, to me, is a very personal composer. I almost feel like he's somebody I literally know. Like, if I were getting emails or texts from this guy, I'm like, oh, come on, Tchaikovsky, it's going to be all right.
Yes, yes. It bears mentioning that he really turned symphonic convention on its head at this point, because he ends the third movement with this just incredible march, and it feels like this just giant victory. And then he snatches it away from you. And the last movement is this very slow. And really, actually, in the end, you hear a heartbeat literally fading out. Mm. And so he goes from the highest of highs to the absolute lowest of lows in a very short amount of time.
His genius was expressing that.
Yes.
His personality really is in the music. Daniel, you seem like someone who's read up and knows the true stories and some of the wild stories. Could we get some clear facts about Tchaikovsky's drama, end of life stuff?
Well, it's interesting. When I was in school, I happened to take a wonderful class with a professor named Roland Wiley. And he was one of the top Russian scholars, at least in the English-speaking world. And I remember taking the class and just being fascinated with his mind. And then he just recently, I think maybe 2009, 2010, published a biography for Cambridge. And so he published the biography, and I got my hands on it. And I thought, finally, I'm going to get some answers. And he does a really great job in this biography of kind of sorting through, you know, fact from fiction. But then by the end, the conclusion is, we'll never know exactly for sure. So what the two options are, how do I describe it? He died very tragically at a young age. And he died rather suddenly, actually 9 days after the premiere of his Sixth Symphony. All of a sudden, he passed away. And it was completely unexpected. The official count was that he had an unboiled glass of water, developed cholera, and died. The unofficial story, the rumors that started spreading immediately after his death and all the way into the early 20th century, was that he actually committed suicide. And there's a whole host of reasons why he did that. It could have been because of who he loved. It could have been because of this and that. And there's all this conjecture out there, and some people, there's even books written about the symphony and how it proves their theory as to why he committed suicide, because they go through the symphony and find all of these hidden messages. I personally think that he died from cholera. I think that there's more evidence towards that, but there's a lot of unanswered questions with that as well. And so you kind of have to just make a decision, and I chose that. And one of the reasons is in that last movement, some conductors in the past have taken that last movement so terribly slow, and it just is slow. And then by the end of the movement, it just gets slower and slower and slower and dies away. But when you look at the score, he's very careful about every tempo marking that he gives. He's very careful about all kinds of things. And in that last part, he says, andante giusto, which is basically a very just walking tempo. And it does not retard until the last three measures. And he also, in that whole section, has lots of big sforzandi, which are big accents, the orchestra really lays into a note and really makes it come alive. And he has that all throughout. And so I feel like at the end, it's maybe he knows he's going to die, but then it's still tragic. And it happens at just the last second. He's still fighting to the end. He's defiant in the face of death. So that's kind of my take on it.
If this discussion is making you excited about seeing the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra on Saturday, don't hesitate to line up your tickets through their website, kalamazoosymphony.com, and also make a pledge to WMUK. We have long time partnered with the KSO to get behind the music and preview these concerts, and that is something we love to do, and we hope that it's something you think is a great idea and that you've gotten something out of it. And a pledge during our fall pledge drive would be gratefully accepted at WMUK.org. It's nice to have, you know, a partner, be able to talk to somebody who really knows the music inside and out, Daniel.
Well, we always enjoy talking. We were talking a little earlier about how it can be lonely in the profession because there's not so many people you can actually talk to about these types of things.
True, true.
Yes. So it's nice to have a person to talk to as well that's interested.
Well, yeah, and Jennifer, you know, leaving school and then meeting someone on the street who asks you what you do, and you say, well, I play violin. And then they're like, oh, that's nice. It's hard to explain sometimes what you are all about.
It is. It seems, I think, for people who are outside of a profession, often it seems somehow mysterious or strange. And I just last week was chatting with a neighbor who asked me how my summer was. And, I hadn't seen the neighbor all summer because I'd been traveling with my family to all these different festivals. And, of course, you know, I'm a performing musician. This is how I make my living. And so the neighbor, after asking a few questions about the various places I'd visited and, oh, how do these festivals work? And then she said, so are you paid to appear at these festivals? And my jaw dropped because I said, well, this is how I make my living. It's not a hobby.
Right.
I don't know if you get those kinds of questions too, but I still get them from, you know, people I meet at, you know, on the street or on planes, who, when they ask what I do, they don't quite understand that, you know, that yes, there's it's an art form that we are deeply engaged with, but it's also our profession.
I also think there's a bit of a danger in people thinking that it's just something you turn on and naturally can do, like without any effort.
There's so much work behind the scenes.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Just to keep yourself in shape, it takes. I mean, for me, it's a mental thing, but for you, it's a physical thing.
Physical and mental. Yeah, it's both.
I will say, I noticed as I was looking for recordings of the Pathetique Symphony today, they start at a minimum of about 42 minutes straight.
Yes. Yeah.
Mentally, physically. Gosh, you are going to be so tired on Saturday night.
I think the
invigorated.
Yeah, the hardest thing is going to bed after a rehearsal or a concert, because my brain is always still processing everything afterwards.
Great.
And I think with that particular symphony, it's one of the fastest 40 minutes you'll ever have, because it's just so engrossing from the first second you hear the music, and it just keeps going.
Right.
I think I would also say that about the Sibelius as well. It's one of those concertos that, you know, that second movement is so beautiful. And it's probably, you know, in all of the Sibelius symphonies and tone poems, there's nothing quite like that second movement. And then the last movement is like a polar bear dance.
That's like the wild rumpus.
Yeah. So really, I mean, both of these pieces, they, you know, time just flies right by when you're listening to it.
I agree. Especially in a live setting.
Yeah.
Well, this interview has flown right by.
Yes.
I can give us the first few measures of this Pathetique Symphony, but that's all, listeners. I have to stop for news, but you can enjoy the full performance Saturday. And I want to thank Jennifer and Daniel for joining me today on WMUK. Thank you very much.
Thank you.